Get your very own copy of the New York Times from May 15, 1948, declaring the State of Israel's independence. A full-size reprint of the entire newspaper covering Israel's reestablishment. Own a piece of history. Click on IsraelCelebrates60.com. Over 25,000 copies have been distributed. That's Israel Celebrates, the number 60.com.
Left-wingers don't know what to do with him. Anti-Semites hate his guts. They would give anything to get him off the radio. Tovia Singer. Coming up next on Israel National Radio.
Singer here, Israel National Radio, IsraelNationalRadio.com. Broadcasting around the world, 1-800-270-4288. You're listening to the Chief Rabbi of News Talk Radio. Don't touch the dial. All right. We are back. All right. We are back. Singer here, Israel National Radio. As a kid, I used to love Elton John. When I found out, I don't remember when it was, like, shouldn't be going through this, but I found out, like, during the 70s that he was gay. I said, there's no way, come on, he couldn't have written all that. All right, that's my brain was as a kid. All right, let's go to the callers. This is my favorite non-Jewish song. See, it's still playing. It's the opening 5 minutes of Funeral for a Friend. We have Simon joining us back, Simon returning back. He has a question, and I wanted to take that question on air. Simon, welcome back to the show. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Tovia. Nice to be back again with you all. Tovia, not so much a question as a comment, but there is a kind of a question in it. Since I've become aware of Judaism and I've known a lot more about Judaism and Jews in general, and nice, good people like yourself and Tamar and everyone else, and Sina and everyone else in INR, and all the people in the chat room, it's a real boost, and it gives you an encouragement to want to press on a bit further. And I've really gone into things in a fairly, shall we say, a fairly convoluted way, and I've been listening to Jewish music on the internet, and I've recorded klezmer music and all kinds of things like that, and I'm really getting into that heart and soul of Judaism, and I don't know why this is, because I've never ever been religious in my life. I was christened as a Christian, supposedly. That is the only dealings I've ever had with religion, plus enforced Sunday school, which I hated, but I soon gave that up and used to bunk off from that. But I've had nothing to do with religion. In fact, I've been vilifying the concept of God ever since I can remember, really. And all of a sudden, at this point in my life, at this late point in my life, I've come to the conclusion that I've been totally wrong, and I've been totally ludicrous in my life, and I've thrown years and years and years away, which I could have been, say, doing productive things and doing something for other people, whereas I've been so selfish and utterly, you know, self-centered. And now all of a sudden, at this point in my life, which is like not quite the twilight years, but we're getting on that way, I find myself drawn to something I've never, ever given any thought to in my life before. And the crazy thing about it is I cannot, for the life of me, understand why this should have happened. I don't think this is down to me alone. I think there are other forces at work, or another force at work, if you like. And I am convinced that God has spoken to me in a way that I would have never listened to years ago. And I've been brought round to this way of thinking and to believing in Judaism and to want to be part of Judaism, although I'm not a Jew. I just want to be near you people and to do what I can for you people, because it seems like it's not just something I'd like to do. It's more than I'd like to do. It's something which is, can I put it another way? It's like, not an obsession even, that's not the right word. It's like a compulsion, that would be the word. It's a compulsion, and I cannot, and I don't want to feel any differently. I'm really getting heavily into Judaism in more ways than I ever thought I could be. I just can't believe the way I've changed over these past 18 months even. So I just wonder what you might make of that.
Well, you know, I'd say this, that be not surprised, because, you know, the Jewish people, a nation whom you've come to adore, had to wander through a desert, a wilderness, for 40 years before they were able to come to the promised land. And the same apparently has happened to you. And, you know, bear in mind that for Jewish people in the United Kingdom, going back many centuries ago, there was an enormous incentive for them to get baptized, convert to Christianity, so they wouldn't be expelled from England, which they were for many centuries, until they were able to finally return some 40 years after Shakespeare was dead. So Jews who wanted to stay in England, who wanted to be able to attend a university in England, even after they were allowed to return, had to get baptized. So there was enormous incentive to become Christians. And then if you didn't want to be persecuted, you kept that a secret. And then you didn't tell your grandchildren that they're Jewish, because you were afraid they would say it and then be discriminated against. So there are many hundreds of thousands, no question, perhaps millions of people in the United Kingdom who are Jewish and are not aware of it. Now, we don't know if you are one of them, but it's quite possible that this is what's happening in your life, that you are discovering a secret that has been kept from you by your family, not because your mother knew it. She may have not been aware of it either. So what I would encourage you to do is to research your genealogy. I'd be very curious to know how many generations your family, your mother's side, have been living in England, which is a country which has a lot of records of baptism. You talk about baptism, birth, death. So this is something you would want to research and find out. You know, who is your mother's mother's mother, and find out if, in fact, you're Jewish, I think. But it wouldn't surprise me. Remember, you know, just going, we don't have to go back that far to when Jewish people did not have equality in England. You know, we don't have to go back many generations. And conversion was the way out. And, you know, if you go back, you know, not that far, before the birth of racial anti-Semitism, it's always been around, but in its full force, often when Jews converted, they were somewhat accepted, and you know, you had a prime minister, Disraeli, who was baptized and so on. So, you know, I would research your genealogy.
Yes, I intend to go down that route, but final point, I would like to say that because of some of the music and some of the articles I read on the internet, I don't watch TV anymore. I've done away with the TV. I just find it's totally useless, especially the BBC. So I rely on Israel National Radio for my daily news now, which is great. But I get into YouTube, and I listen to quite a lot of Jewish music, and there's some really wonderful stuff on there. But I find this is another thing, and I'll admit this to you because I don't feel silly about it, but I tend to burst into tears for little or no reason. I get very emotional on anything Jewish. If there's something like a really beautiful song or a very melancholy song, there's one on the internet that I posted. I put the link up there earlier. Shemai Israel. It's sung in English, but that makes me burst into tears, and I don't mind admitting that, whether I'm a man or not, you know, it makes no difference to me. I'll admit it quite openly. And I would do this. I've never been so emotionally close to the surface of things as I am now. I used to try and hide things away and keep them to myself, but I find I'm just so emotionally open now. It's just fantastic, and I'm sure there's some plan for me. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure God has some plan for me. I would like to think that.
Simon, I think you know exactly what it is. You know precisely what's happening and in your life. You have articulated far better than I could have. I think it's very clear what's happening in your life, and I think you ought to start uncovering your history, because you apparently are an imposter Gentile who needs to find out who you really are. So I bless you. Continue that path. There is a website called jewishgen.org. That's Jewish and then G-E-N, as in genetics, .org. And you can, it's a huge database website. And you can research your family's, your ancestral line, and find out if you, in fact, are Jewish and never knew that, okay? So, Simon, welcome home, and thank you so much for joining us here on Israel National Radio. You are a blessing, all right?
Thank you, Tovia.
Thank you. Let's go to Jared, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind, Jared?
Hi, Tovia. How are you today?
Doing well.
I just had a quick question, and I'll hang up to hear the answer. I'm having a hard time hearing you, but my question is multiple parts. First, I'll go off my understanding in the Jewish religion. I am a non-Jew, that there is no eternal hell except for the extremely wicked. And the reason I'm asking this question is because I have a lot of Christian friends, and I started discussing the Noahide laws with them and things like that, which, as a side note, they had no idea about. But what I was trying to find out, and one of the comments that they had mentioned to me was, and it's almost that fear tactic of, well, if I believe in Jesus, I'm not going to go to hell, versus you, if you believe in Judaism and the Noahide laws, and you're wrong, you're going to go to hell. So, almost like that, I have nothing to lose by believing in Jesus mentality. So I'll hang up. I don't know what kind of comment
don't hang
you
up.
Have
don't,
to that.
Don't hang up. Don't hang up. I like your voice, and just stick around. I mean, are you able to hear me clearly?
I can hear you a little bit now.
All right, let me try this out. I'd like to keep you on for a second. Why hell is described in Tanakh, but very rarely, very rarely. Why don't the prophets of Israel openly, explicitly, and repeatedly threaten Jews who do not behave properly or don't believe properly that they're going to go to hell? It's all over the Christian Bible, but it is in Tanakh, in the Jewish Bible, and it's actually not even a threat. In the Jewish Bible, it's mentioned, and it's not even the threat. The reason is that the threat of going to hell is designed for one purpose, and that is to get you to suspend your ability to reason through, to frighten you to death. To frighten you to hell. It means, well, what it's saying to you is, look, if you don't believe in what I believe, you're going to suffer something so horrible that just stop thinking, stop using your brain, and stop trying to figure out the truth, because you're going to get yourself into hell. It's the way to get you to suspend your ability to reason. That's what the purpose of it is, to frighten you. So, do the very wicked, are they punished eternally? Absolutely. But that is not why, that is not how we determine what is God's truth. We do that by one method alone, and that is we use the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, as a ruler, as a reed, as a measuring tool to know what the truth is and what the truth isn't. Because Islam claims if you don't believe in Muhammad, you're going to go to hell. You know, and I don't know what Buddhism exactly believes in, but there's like reincarnation. You don't stop until you know. But the idea of threatening you, it's like someone getting raped. You know, when a gun is put to her head and said, you know, if you don't do this, I'm going to kill you, she does things she would not ordinarily do. So the reason why people use the threat of hell is because that's the best argument they have, to scare you. The idea is not to frighten you, but actually to have you reason the answer of what God's truth is. And it's very easy to do that if you just look at the Torah, look at the prophets of Israel, and then measure any teaching. You're talking about Christianity. Measure the claims of Paul against the claims of the Torah, against the claims of King David. Are they consistent? Then they should be considered. If they are not congruent, then they should be rejected. Not because someone told you you're going to go to hell. That's what I would say. Did you understand that, Jared?
I did, and I appreciate that. I would classify myself as probably knowing barely enough to be dangerous on both topics. So, you know, like the last caller, I guess being drawn is probably the best verbiage I can use to describe,
right,
you know, some of the feelings that I'm having lately towards, you know, religion and Judaism as a whole. So, you know, I'll keep doing the work and keep investigating, and wherever it leads, it leads. And, but, you know, I appreciate your time, and thanks for helping.
Don't go yet, okay? I'm going to explain this point maybe even more clearly. This is a very important issue. You see, when somebody dies, Ecclesiastes chapter 12 tells us that after they die, their soul goes to heaven, okay? But it's a big mystery. We can't see with our eyes, we can't perceive with our senses of what happens after you die. Every dead body, whether it's a dead body of a wicked person or a righteous person, they look the same. So there's no way for us, using our senses, our physical senses, to perceive what happens to a person's soul when they die. It's just, we have no access to that, right? Right, we don't. The old dead people look the same. Correct, Jared?
Correct.
All right.
To my knowledge,
yeah. Let's think about this for a moment. What we can perceive with our eyes, with our ears, with our mind, is the Torah, the prophets of Israel. We can read it, we can understand their message, and we can measure any claim against it. Right? So here we have two things. We have the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, and then we have what happens after you die. What happens after you die, there's no way for us to tell. We can't perceive by, there are wicked people who die old, there are righteous people who die young, the dead bodies, they all look the same, they smell the same. We can't perceive what happens to the soul. So what these Christians are saying to you is, trust in something you can't see, you have no clue, just, I'm telling you this, and ignore what you can see. Do you understand how ridiculous this is? They're saying to you, ignore what is right in your face, what you could see with your eyes. Look at, when you see what Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, verse 6 and 7 and 8, which completely contradicts the claims of the church. Psalm 40, verse 6, verse 6, 7 and 8, where it talks about sin and atonement, and that a person who, or Jeremiah chapter 7, where the prophet condemns sacrifices and says, do not depend on blood for atonement. I mean, these are appalling statements to the church. Psalm 40, verse 6, or verse 7 in the Christian Bible, where King David says, I don't even want sacrifices. God wants the ears to be opened. So what happens is, you can read these texts, see them with your eyes, perceive them with your mind, you can hear them with your ears, right? And then you have the claims of people who say, when you die, if you don't do this, you know, these people go to heaven and hell, but you can't tell. So what they're saying is, you should actually sublimate what you could see in here for what you can see in here. That's what they're telling you. And the purpose of it is to get you to ignore what you are observing for the purpose of believing in something that you cannot observe. Not only can't you observe it, but the claims of the church are contravened by the clearest statements in the Jewish scriptures. That's why just use your ears, not just physical, spiritual ears, your eyes, read, listen, understand, and then make a decision based on that, not on any fear tactic. Because they know you can't see it, so it's like, you know, it's a distraction. That's all it's trying to do. Trying to say, don't think, just be afraid of going to hell, and that's why believe what I believe. That's what it's about. Okay? So, you know, that's really what's happening. The idea is stop thinking. Now, what I'm saying is, take the Jewish Bible. It's a measuring tool. It's an eternal document. It is Kiner Mitzvah V'Torah Or, Proverbs 6:13. The commandment is a candle. The Torah is light. Use this light. Use this candle to illuminate, to perceive, to make spiritual eternal decisions, and then act upon them, not on fear. That's all. Does that make sense?
It does.
There you go.
It's just that. So it's pretty clear what their motivation was. It just, again, it helps to hear, you know, more about what you said about, you know, reading and understanding, and I think that's the next step here. So.
Look, I mean, imagine this. Think about this, and we have about 2 minutes left. Do you have children?
I do.
All right. So imagine you have more than one child. If one child does something that's very wrong, what you do is, instead of punishing that child or warning that child, what you do is you punish the child who didn't do anything wrong. And that you'd be considered a cruel parent. Well, that's what you're supposed to believe happened. That God lets wicked people off the hook and punishes somebody who's innocent. I mean, don't you think there's a reason why the Aztecs and the Mayans and all these religions believe that virgins who should be thrown into volcanoes, should be sacrificed, that children are sacrificed? Why is it that all these pagan religions support the killing of an innocent for the sins of the wicked? Why? Why don't any of these pagan religions believe that murderers and rapists should be sacrificed and thrown into fire? Why do they always sacrifice the innocent? That's a pagan concept. It's just not a part of God's plan. Just like your father, you would never treat your children that way. God, who loves you more than we can ever even love our own children, would never treat us that way. Thank you so much for joining us here on Israel National Radio. All right. 1-800-270-4288, the number to dial anywhere around the world. Listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. Don't touch the dial. Hashem Echad, welcome to Hashem's army. I want to reveal His glory. If you feel ready, then follow me to Yerushalayim. Hu noten li hakoach, Ikar Asar Ez Amidbar. Practice what you preach, b'chol levavcha u'b'chol nashecha. This is my love.
If you love Israel and you're coming to the Holy Land, you need Israel's best tour guide. See Israel like you've never seen it before. Mayor Eisenman will take you around the country for an educational and fun experience. Each tourist gets a personally designed tour. The land of the Bible, the land of the Tanakh, comes alive in the hands of an energetic and experienced tour guide. Visit IsraelByMayor.com. That's Israel by Mayor, M-E-I-R, or email him directly at IsraelByMayor@gmail.com.
Kedashta, the personal touch, invite everyone to their two exciting stores, one in the heart of Jerusalem and one in Modi'im. Kedashta, the personal touch, is the epitome of elegant style and service. Sterling silver, artistic glassware, jewelry, talitot, mezuzot, and much more. And also features a full boutique wine department specializing in Israeli wines. And, of course, everything is available online at Judaica4U, Judaica, the numeral 4 and the letter U.com.
Now, the only independent news talk network in the Middle East, Israel National Radio, presents the Tovia Singer Show. Here's Tovia Singer!
Singer here, Israel National Radio, IsraelNationalRadio.com. You can call right now, 1-800-270-4288. That is Jordan Chaviv you're listening to. I love this guy's soul. JordanChaviv.com. I'm going to give him a plug. I'm getting some phone calls, some emails lately. People worried about the Jewish state, wondering if we have enough ammunition to fight the enemy. We have the God of Israel. All right, we are back. The Rebbe is back right here on Israel National Radio, taking your calls and questions. 1-800-270-4288, the number to dial anywhere around the world. We have Elisheva Miriam. Just call me Tovia. Welcome to the show, Elisheva. Just say...
It's hard for me not to say it,
no,
but I won't.
No,
okay.
Tovia, hello. There's no titles.
Hello, Tovia.
Well,
good
all.
To hear your voice again. We missed you all so much.
Yes.
Listen, I was going to dovetail off what you were talking about in respect to Elton John's reaction toward the Arab nations. You know, I think it was very nice that he said what he said, that they, you know, that they kill homosexuals. You know, he at least was honest about that. And you've said that several times, you know, how, you know... Anyway, my point being is there's a lot of talk about, oh, you know, he's gay and blah, 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 blah. And I would like you to clarify the Jewish teaching about God hating the sin, not the sinner. And, you know, because in Christianity, you know, you're damned for all eternity, blah, 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 the eternal sin. And, you know, and if that were the case, how anybody... How could God, you know, because when we repent, it's like the sin never existed. How could that be if God hated us? You know, God never hates the person; He hates the sin, right?
Well,
what is this? Let me
just explain this point.
I'm going to get off the air and let you explain.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Let me explain this point. Because I mean, you know, I don't want to sound like Jesse Jackson, who as an orator, relies on phrases that rhyme for truth. You know, God hates a sinner, loves a sin. That's just talk. Okay? All of mankind has free will. So on the one hand, there is a desire within each and every one of us to do what is right. But we also have a proclivity, a temptation towards sin. And we live and struggle with that temptation until we die. And we are forbidden to trust in what decisions we will make until the day we die. We don't do that. But understand that our desire, temptation to sin is a blessing, or it can be a curse. Because if one has a temptation to sin, and one resists that temptation, then that person is righteous. If a person has no temptation, then what is their reward? In classical Jewish thinking, virtue is impossible unless one chooses it. And you can't choose faithfulness and godliness unless you are also genuinely rejecting a sin. So, instead of using terms like sin and sinner, we all have temptations. Some of us have different temptations, but we struggle with temptation. To the extent that we're able to reject sin and embrace the God of Israel, that is That is how virtue is produced, and therefore we should celebrate our Yetzirah, our evil inclination. It's a great blessing. If we had no inclination to sin, virtue would be impossible. We could not choose the God of Israel. If someone puts a knife to your throat and says, "Say you love me or I'll kill you," and you say, "I love you," in Jewish thinking, that statement would be meaningless. It's only meaningful when your ability to love God is as great as your ability to rebel against him. Now, there is, however, in Christian thinking, so that's not really the issue. The issue is that that Paul makes in one of his writings. And for some reason, I don't mean to be anti, I'm not being anti-Christian. I'm just, I think it's important to you to respond to this question appropriately. And, you know, there are 13 letters in the Christian Bible that are attributed to Paul. Seven of them are certainly from his hand. The most important, where we find the greatest abundance of Christian theology, is the Book of Romans. And the Book of Romans is the most, when I say authentic book of Paul, what I mean is that when scholars are looking at all the letters attributed to Paul, what they're really doing is they're saying which books were written by the same person who wrote the Book of Romans. That's how important Romans is. Romans and Galatians are probably two theologically most important. That's where so much of Christian theology emerges from. And Paul makes the claim that the wages of sin are death. That once someone sins, that there is nothing that they can do on their own to propitiate against God's wrath. They can do nothing to reconcile themselves with God. God is angry. And therefore, you need, and there's nothing you can do on your own to make things right with God. Okay? So what I want to do is I'm trying my hardest to avoid God loves, hates the sin, the sinner. Those are just words. The truth is that all of us have free will, and all of us have a propensity towards sin as we do towards saintliness. It's always a perfect balance. If that balance was ever interfered with, was ever injured, then virtue would become impossible. Now, the claim of the church, going back to its earliest writings, and the letters of Paul really are the earliest writings of Christianity, the claim is that once somebody sins, and he's hopeless, there's nothing he can do to redeem himself. And not only that, you can't repent on your own. You need something magical to believe in, and that is the death of an innocent one. And I mentioned this to Jared earlier, that this pattern of saying, forget about trying to develop a relationship with God on your own. Take an infant and pass it through a fire. Take a virgin and throw into a volcano. Take a sinless God-man and crucify him. What they all have in common is it that innocent ones, it's a baby, innocent, a virgin, innocent, a Jesus, innocent, and kill him or her instead of the sinner having to pay. And that satisfies the gods, the triune Godhead. This message, this Christian message, is what the prophets of Israel fought against consistently. And they lived a half a millennia before Christianity would be spawned. So the question I always encourage listeners to do is to say, well, what does God think about that? I mean, what is God's opinion on if someone has sinned, has done something that is wrong in the eyes of God, what does God want? Are they done with? Is God filled with wrath? Because that's how Christians feel. Christians, and not just Christians, but other religions feel that God is just perfect, and therefore he can't tolerate our sin. And therefore something has to, an intercessor has to substitute our own sinful being in order to align ourselves with God. So I would encourage a person to read the book of Ezekiel. And it's important to understand that Ezekiel wasn't somebody who had any axe to grind with Christianity, because Ezekiel lived 500 years before the advent of the church. And Ezekiel, and again, I will also set up a context for you. Ezekiel lived, preached, taught after the destruction of the first temple in Babylon, where the Jews he was speaking to had experienced something cataclysmic. The first temple was destroyed. It means there so many rituals in the service in the sanctuary were not available. And people thought they can rely on those rituals to save them. Jeremiah, who prophesied while the first temple stood, just read Jeremiah 7. It nearly got Jeremiah killed. He was nearly put to death for preaching that sermon in the 7th chapter. If you read it, it will blow your mind away. It will literally, your brain will start to tremble. Where he screams at this idea that you think you can rely on sacrifices and blood. He says, forget about it. It won't help you. These rituals won't help you. In Ezekiel, who prophesied just a little bit later than Jeremiah, in chapter 18, first of all, he begins with a very angry tone. Because this idea wasn't born in the first century. In fact, the idea of substitutionary atonement is ensconced in every pagan religion. In Judaism, it's only really the unintentional sin that could be atoned for through a sacrifice. There are exceptions, but the exceptions really prove my point, and there's not enough time to go into it. Now, if you ask me about it, I'll talk about it. Just do it on air. So Ezekiel says, where have I heard this idea that the innocent can suffer the sins of the wicked? That cannot happen. That's what Ezekiel 18 is all about. Okay? Ezekiel 18 is there, and there are many chapters like this. You can read Micah 6:6, and Hosea said, well, just kind of in one chapter. He says, this cannot be the soul that sinned. It's the one that's held accountable. Now, so Ezekiel sets up, first of all, that the innocent can't die for the sins of the wicked. Okay? That would be a monumental problem for the cross, for the church, for Christendom. But then, as he moves through the chapter, he comes through to the point where you're going, all right, I'm in trouble because I have sinned in my life. So literally, two-thirds through the chapter, he then turns to the wicked person. And he says, what about the soul that sins? What about the wicked person? This is in verse 21, where he says, as for the wicked person, what should he do? Now, remember, when he's writing this, there's no temple, there's no sacrificial system. Jews are almost all in Babylon. And you would think if Ezekiel believed in Jesus, or he would say, you know, believe in Jesus, or Jesus is going to come, you're going to believe in him beforehand. So, no. He says, as for the wicked person, I would encourage you to measure this to Romans 6:10, where Paul claims that the wages of sin are death and there is no hope for the sinner. Verse 21, he says, as for the wicked person, and you can read this incidentally in any Bible. You can use a Christian Bible for this, because the Christian Bible does not tamper with these texts, with this particular text. He says, if the wicked person turns from his sins that he committed, and turning means repenting and then doing what is right, he will live. It's a spiritual living. He will not die. Now, you're asking, well, what about I've done these horrific things in my life? I've done things my wife doesn't know, and she knew she'd kill me. He says that none of the transgressions, this is verse 22. The whole chapter is just 32 verses. Verse 22 is none of his transgressions that he committed will be remembered against him. They're gone. Because you've turned your life to righteousness. Now, the next verse is the one I really want you to concentrate on, because the notion is, again, so instead of getting into the Jesse Jackson language, you know, it's not the sinner, it's the sin, what does that all mean? We're all, you know, I quit smoking a long time ago, but I can pick up a cigarette right now and start smoking. I every day, I mean, it's there. The temptation is there. And thank God I fight it. But it's there. You, whoever you are, you're listening to my voice right now, you've got your temptation, you know, a whole series of them. But the question is, is he so full of wrath that he wants to punish the wicked? The next verse, 23, says, these are unbelievable words. I assure you, if there is a listener who went to Christian seminary, you did not study this verse. I assure you that if you were raised a Christian, you did not hear this verse preached from a pulpit in your church, because it would not resonate for you. It would not resonate in a cathedral. These are the words of God. Have I any pleasure at all in the death of the wicked? Now, this is not Ezekiel's opinion. He then wants to make it clear that this is what the God says. Do I desire at all? Do I take any pleasure at all in the death of the wicked? This is what God says. Or is it rather that he should turn away from his sinful ways and live? Now, one may say, was Ezekiel like a counter-missionary? Was he anti-Christian? You know, people like to say, I'm anti-Christian. I'm not anti-Christian. Ezekiel's not anti-Christian. It's not like, when I say anti-Christian, I don't mean like we just don't like them. No. These are ideas that are very appealing, incidentally. You know, people like to put down the theology of Christianity is like stupidity. The notion of vicarious atonement is extremely attractive, and you have to respect it. It's an enemy, but it's very tempting. The reason it's tempting is that we know the terrible things we've done in our own lives, and we wonder, would God ever really forgive me? I mean, deep down, you're listening to my voice right now. There are things that you would never tell anyone that you've done in your life. There are things you've done in your youth that you would never share with anyone. But you are also deeply aware of the fact that God is aware of those actions you've done that you probably regret or not proud of. So you're going, I am in huge trouble. Because even though my best friend doesn't know some of the things I've done, God knows it all, and he'll never forgive me. I couldn't forgive someone for such betrayal. And therefore, we assume, or there is a desire to believe, that it is attractive to embrace a notion that there has to be something outside of our own behavior, which seems so reckless, something like magical. Well, that's what will appease God, because nothing I can do can appease God, because I've screwed up so many times in my life. So the notion of taking an infant and passing it through a fire, killing an innocent person, taking a virgin who's done nothing and appeasing the gods through the death of the innocent is so attractive. It's disgusting, but it's attractive in that it seems like nothing rational I can think of could appease God. Can reconcile myself with God. I need something to vicariously atone for me, because nothing I can do responsibly can change that. And the answer is, it's a lie. And the prophets fought against it. Almost all the latter prophets scream, especially those who, at the end of the first temple, during this, what am I saying, in the middle first temple, Isaiah, the book of Psalms, when the temple hadn't yet been built, they all cried against it. And the reason there's so much screaming about this era is because it's attractive. It's very appealing to say, I just got to believe in this thing, that this innocent virgin, innocent man died for me, and then I'm off the hook. He paid the price for me, because I can never pay the price. And the mistake you make is that you think that God is like you, that you have trouble forgiving others who have betrayed you. So God probably has trouble forgiving me, because if I were God, I'd never forgive me. So something weird has to happen. So understand the appeal of substitutionary atonement and resist it with everything that you have. You listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. Ah, yes. Doesn't that make you feel better? Raise your eyes to the mountains. Where is my help going to come from? Listen carefully. That's it. It's the only source. Your help, redemption, comes from the God who created the heavens and the earth. Don't be afraid. Don't let your foot become tired, for the guardian of Israel never sleeps nor slumbers. 22 hours, we'll be back on air. Shalom.
יום השמש לא יקקה וירח בלילה, השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך, השם ישמור צאתך ובואך, מעתה ועד עולם. שיר המעלות, שא עיני אל הערים, מאין יבוא עזרי? עזרי מעם השם, עושה שמיים וארץ, אל יתן עמוד רגליך, אל ינום שומרך. הנה לא ינום ולא ישן, שומר ישראל.
Hi, this is Jeff Cohen, and we're here visiting at the Arutz Sheva radio station. We've been visiting Israel for our nephew's bar mitzvah, and we are very happy to come here and visit, as we listen all the time. Oh, my favorite Israeli radio station is Arutz Sheva, Israel National Radio.
Israel is known for its breakthroughs in medical research, including the field of herbal supplements. Prisho Opuntimal is dedicated to the wellness of men and women, particularly in the areas of prostate and urinary tract health. We make it affordable for you to get the very best natural health supplements available. Don't just suffer. Get Prisho brand Opuntimal. Order it online at prisho.com. That's P-R-I-S-S-O.com.